For March 30th, 2017, it's the Lullabot Podcast. It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 208. I'm Matt Klee, the senior developer at Lullabot. With me, as always, front-end dev, Florida Gator, Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hey, so Mike, today we're kind of split in the middle here. I'm represent the show as the token back-end dev. You're the front-end dev. We're going to talk something a little bit different, but just as important to the development process of building websites, right?
Correct, yeah. So evidently there are more stuff besides front-end development and back-end development when you build a website. You also have to design the website, and even before that...
Wait, though, we just talked to our designers like a couple of podcasts ago, right?
User testing, yeah.
User testing. So what else is there?
Well, we're about to find out. On with us today, we have our creative director at Lullabot. He leads all of our design efforts, including our team of designers. And over the course of his career, he has led design efforts and provided design and UX consulting to clients like MIT, Time Warner, NBC, Intel, AAA, and the Grammys. From Roswell, Georgia, with no aliens, welcome Jared Ponchat.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, this is Roswell, Georgia, not New Mexico.
Yeah, and there are no aliens. I've been there. Yeah, it's a safe place, yeah.
It's North Atlanta, basically.
Also with us, we have a senior digital strategist at Lullabot. No stranger to the Lullabot podcast and his own podcast as well. Insert content here. Responsible for Drupal Execute and some of the form API. He has 12 years, 2 months on Drupal.org with a 5-digit user ID from Geneva, Illinois. It's Jeff Eaton. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, it's great to be on the podcast again. This should definitely be a fun one.
Yeah.
Way to make me feel old, though.
So we're talking about the intersection of design and content strategy, where the roles of these two folks in our organization kind of come together and make it happen. So I guess we can start, like, Eaton, what is content strategy?
Well, that's a big question. I think one of the best definitions that I've heard in a long time is basically it's the process of figuring out what you're going to be creating and publishing, where it's coming from, who's making it, who it's targeted towards, what messages it's supposed to communicate, when and where it will appear, and how you're going to manage it. And anybody who comes from a journalism background will recognize the classic 5 W's and an H: who, what, when, where, why, and how in there. That's a little sneaky trick. But basically, it's the process by which you figure out, like, all of the ugly, messy stuff about what your content is actually going to be and where it's coming from. Classically, it tends to be more on, like, the editorial or production or management of content side. Sometimes it brings in things like governance, like who's responsible for determining when a page on the website needs to be updated, or, you know, even broader than websites, who's responsible for determining what the canonical version of, say, a particular message is, if it appears in a brochure and in an email and on the website, what's the official version, stuff like that. In our project, it tends to get a little more into the weeds and touch on the technical aspects of things like data migration, content modeling, editorial workflow in the CMS, how the actual, you know, meat of the content we're getting from a client matches up with the design that, you know, the visual design work that's being done, stuff like that. So it covers a lot of bases, but it's one of those things that I think often happens in the margins, even if people don't realize it and, you know, make an explicit discipline out of it.
So you mentioned seeing if your content actually fits the design. So does content strategy typically come after the design?
And not necessarily. It's one of those things that sort of happens in conjunction a lot of times, in like the classic agency model of, like, you know, big, you know, marketing or design agencies and stuff like that. Content strategy is actually usually something that's underneath the umbrella of, like, a design team or something like that. And I think probably understanding why that's the case Jared's probably like in a good position to explain why, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what the design, you know, label covers.
Jared, if you would, yeah, explain what the design team.
I was just going to say it's a little bit like, you know, you can, it's like, should the plumbing and all that be decided after a home is already designed? And it's, while you could do that, you could sort of outfit it, like in architecture, you have things like master planning where you're like aware of both, you know, the natural surroundings on the ground and where plumbing is designed to enter from the city and how the sewer connects and all those things and where it's going to be coming up. And a good designer for a building is going to actually want to know those things and try to work with those things as opposed to against them. And so I think as in terms of like, I would say that content strategy has often been thought of at times as like sort of a part of a good UX design practice or something like that. But I don't think it's just hard to define necessarily whether I'm one of these people that has a hard time not looking at almost everyone as a designer in what we do in some way. Definitions are elusive things.
I've actually got a question, because this is something that we've talked a lot about, and I know it was actually fairly controversial on Twitter, I think maybe a week or so ago. Jared Spool made a comment about everyone involved in making decisions about a product ultimately being, you know, having the responsibilities of a designer, and somebody got really, really angry about that. You know, it's like saying, oh, you know, I guess anybody can be a designer then. And it seemed clear that they were sort of missing what he was getting at. It sounds like you're saying something similar.
Well, I'm just saying you can look at it that way. I don't know if I would, it's not a hill to die on for me, but because I do think there's the aspect of it, like where you don't say, everyone who had a hand in choosing what restaurant we go to is actually a chef tonight. I do think that there is something to the practice of design and not necessarily everyone. It depends on what you mean by the word. I think I've always loved Victor Papanek's definition of design, which was design is the conscious effort to impose a meaningful order. And in that sense, that's sort of like, whether you call that design with a capital D, it's like, most of us are in the work that we do, whether your title is front-end developer, your title is React developer or Drupal developer or UX designer or UI designer, whatever, like if you're doing your job well, you're probably engaged in that kind of a practice of trying to make a conscious effort to impose meaningful order and to sort of set up something that's sustainable and as nice as possible and all that. But and I'm guessing that's what, I didn't get involved in that thread from Jared Spool's comment, but I'm guessing that's sort of at the heart of what he's talking about, is that there are lots of design decisions and that design thinking is sort of critical throughout whether you call yourself a designer or not. But I mean, there are things like, you know, like I said, definitions are elusive, but there are ways people define these things. Historically, like in the web, you have people who call themselves UX designers. You might think of UX designers as people who are there to protect like the way it feels to use this product. Like, what does it feel like to use this thing? Like, a UX designer should care a lot about those. You have things, people called UI designers, and oftentimes they're thought of as the people who care a lot about the way it looks, the way the thing looks. And I think emerging, you have this thing people are talking about called a product designer. And it sounds to me like when people use that word, they're often meaning people who care about the look and the feel together. and I think that's like, as a design team, at least at Lullabot, and I think at a lot of, you know, good shops, and there are a lot of great shops out there, you, at least within a team, even if you don't have every skill and practice within each individual, you kind of have that, doing what we do, at least you have that sort of product design mentality where you're trying to make sure that what the experience is like of using this thing is great, and that the thing itself looks good and is appealing to people before they even use it, before they discover how nice it is to use or how easy it is to do the thing that they wanted to do or that sort of thing. And I think strategy is another one of these things, Jeff. I'd be curious to hear you talk about this, because some people would hear Jeff's a digital strategist and they might think, that he's concerned with, like, should we make this thing, or should the thing even exist, or what should we even be making? And I feel like while there are strategists out there who that's kind of what they do for organizations, even the kind of organizations we work with, our digital strategists typically are more like there to help when you've decided we have this problem set, we have these, we've built this audience, and we've recognized this need or those kinds of things. And it's like, not necessarily what should we do, but like, we have an idea of how to approach that. Help us flesh that out better. Help us ensure that the way we're going to do this is going to be successful. And there's that concern is very much the concern also of a good UX design practice. And strategy is such a key part of that, that I think it's just sort of become this thing where it's like, you couldn't really be a good design shop and not have strategy as a part of your projects.
Yeah. I think it's funny that, you know, you mentioned what exactly does a digital strategist do? Because I've never been able to get a very precise answer for that. It's a fairly like broad umbrella. Like for some people, it means, oh, I'm the person who handles our analytics and makes sure that we're, you know, targeting things, and I do ad buys, and, you know, it has a heavy emphasis on, like, you know, making sure that strategically we're targeting the right, you know, content and getting traffic and stuff like that. Inside of Lullabot, at least, and I think this is fairly common inside of a lot of Drupal shops and like development-heavy CMS implementation shops, we sort of consider digital strategy to be about making sure that we've got a very clear grasp of like the goals and the needs and what we're going to be measuring and like what the core, what the core essence of this project and product are. It's not quite the same as like a project manager or something like that, because it's less about, you know, breaking everything down into the specific tickets as making sure that we're all collectively, you know, all the different disciplines inside of the project are on the right page, that the stakeholders, you know, for on the client side are being represented, that there aren't serious, you know, damaging gaps in, you know, who's at the table and what's being accounted for. And then as we go from like these early sort of discovery and, you know, I think what you refer to, Jared, as the ideation phase, and, you know, start developing things more clearly, as it moves into more of a development and implementation and rollout phase, at least inside of Lullabot, a lot of the digital strategy role is also about making sure that there's a smooth transition there and that there isn't sort of the traditional, like, handoff gap of understanding the initial goals and sort of the vibe of what what the client is trying to accomplish and the actual building of it. Because it feels like often there's like a ton of like thinking and discovery and hard chewing on complicated questions that goes on. And then, an organization and the team who's, you know, working on that early phase will arrive at some key decisions and then write down those decisions and sort of hurl them over the wall to a development team, but never really capture any of the nuanced and complicated thinking that made those decisions happen. And that can be really tough for a development team because oftentimes, no matter how good the original thinking was, there's still other questions that arise during the process of actually building out something of any complexity. And you have to understand the whys behind those decisions in order to really continue making decisions, you know, when questions come up that really reflect those sort of motivations. And I think that's a really, really common gap where it's like, oh, but we documented everything we wanted you to do. And, but
yeah. So how do you make that transition more smooth? Are like you as a Drupal developer, do you kind of lay out content types or do you convey maybe some suggested content types to the backend developer?
Yeah. It feels like this is, a little more concrete than sort of the we ideate, we goalify.
How's your synergy?
I can see you as you're ideating, you know, laying in a hammock eating grapes.
Yeah, no, I'm told that a Jeff Eaton impression is really all in the elbows. You just have to get in front of a whiteboard and wave your arms really vigorously. But yeah, no, I mean, I think like for us, a lot of it is, you know, and this is where for us, the digital strategy stuff really leans heavily on content strategy, because so much of the work that we do is with like basically big content publishing and management projects. Mm-hmm. Detailed inventories and assessments and audits of what materials the client has on hand already. Often we're working with, you know, organizations that have a fairly large existing library of content, whether they're happy with it or not. Then starting to plan content types and, you know, sort of the content model and the structures and the relationships between them, we consider sort of part of the, you know, the more technical aspects of the content strategy process. And then I think that sort of dovetails with I think what Jared and his team consider part of the design process, which is sort of figuring out, you know, what are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish? And what are you trying to communicate? Because that kind of stuff informs the work that's going on in the content strategy process too. You know, understanding that stuff, you know, we're not just sort of lifting and moving all of their existing stuff. We're trying to figure out what could be done differently from what you have now to meet the goals that you know you have. Does that make sense?
Yeah. As I understand it, you guys have this down to a process now. So when a large publisher calls or shines their bot signal and says that they're in need of what
Jeff
you do,
and I both scream to the bot cave.
Nice.
<Ba-na-na-na-na-na-na>.
So when you spring into action and jump in with a new client that needs this kind of work, I understand there's some sort of workshop process that you guys kick off with them and kind of figure out the needs.
Yeah, I would say it'd be a rare project for us to work on where we do some projects where we may not show up on site at some point and do a big workshop. And those tend to be smaller sort of consulting kinds of projects, like a very focused need that's clearly articulatable. And yeah, actually, I remember working with Jeff on a project for Harvard where it was like a very specific user problem kind of a thing. And we were able to sort of workshop with them live remotely and work it through in a very short period of time. But most of the bigger work that we do, you know, when this old house came to us and they, you know, sort of wanted to rethink the digital experience, there's a period usually of, you know, a week or two leading up to this real workshopping work that in which we often are doing interviews with a lot of people. And we've done this where that those interviews have been with, you know, seven people that are really key to the product or project, or, you know, and a user or two of the product, or those kinds of things that kind of help orient everything that is going to happen in the workshopping. And we've also done it where we've literally interviewed 50 people in a week across an entire
organization. That was pretty intense.
That was crazy intense. I actually don't recommend people trying that, but so I think maybe one of the things that I like the most about Lullabot and the way we approach this is we're very pragmatic. We're very, I think we've a number of us have worked at places like the places our clients the kinds of things that they do. I mean Jeff and Greg, our two strategists, come from an editorial background even, and so we have a high level of empathy not just for the end users of the stuff that we're making, but for the businesses that need to support these things. And so we know that like most people coming to us, like the last thing they want to hear is we're going to spend 2 months doing this research so that we can come to you and tell you a bunch of things that you thought you kind of already knew or something like that. So when we say workshopping, or like we actually often even don't use the word discovery because it just communicates all kinds of things that maybe aren't what we're about to do. It's sort of a mix of really efficient research, that's translated very quickly into the creation of real ideas. Like, okay, based on these priorities that we've now all agreed upon together, what if we did it like this? And what if it looked kind of like this? Usually by the end of our workshopping phase, there are at the very least pencil sketches of a number of the most key parts of what make up this thing, whether it's a website or whatever. And so it's not a, it's not purely an information gathering phase, which I think is what people often think of when they hear discovery or even research is like information gathering. So, I mean, that's a part of it, but it's hopefully a part that's not extremely expensive.
So after the workshop, you're hoping you have a game plan that is actionable.
Yeah, usually we you know, in this workshopping, like one of the most common things that I think that designers and strategists work on all the time early in these projects is actually something that developers who never even get the chance to be a part of a design process end up facing as well, which is competing priorities. Like you'll have sometimes even like requirements lists that seem like their intention or something. And a lot of the work that we do in this early workshopping phase is identifying the places where either within the actual team that's going to sort of own and sustain this product, or whether from the users of the thing or the representatives of who we think is going to use it, and those that there's competing priorities that we're not really sure what's most important here. And so a lot of times, you know, the work that we do is bring in what's, you know, sort of historically been common UX practices to sort of, rather than just like sitting around a table and asking everybody, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? And then taking our notes about how nobody agrees, that we're actually forcing them into exercises that let somebody be a decider, but let that decider be informed by the team that really cares. And
yeah.
I've seen it be really powerful. It can be a lot of work and hard, but it's usually, I mean, it's extremely valuable going into any project feeling like we all agree about what's the most important thing here and maybe these three things that follow it. And we all understand why those are most important.
Jeff, we've been in a conference room together and been offered steak dinners for features, right?
Yes.
for where stakeholders don't necessarily agree on
what needs
to happen. It sounds like this process is forcing that.
To a certain extent, that is a really big part of it. And I think like a lot of the reason that Lullabot got started building like a deliberate strategy and design practice, like design is a practice in the way that Jared is talking about it, not just yes, we can in fact do theming and, you know, Photoshop work before the build out, the real like chewing on these questions with a you know, client and ironing those things out. We got into that as a company just because we found out that even if we didn't say we were doing it, we ended up having to have these conversations and sort these questions out just in order to make sure that the project actually worked successfully, because I've literally never been on a project where there weren't issues with like, you know, needs or desires on the part of stakeholders that couldn't be resolved with budgets or timelines or other competing interests. Like I think one of the classic ones that I've seen a couple of times is the idea that, we want to, you know, dramatically increase traffic, but we also want to, you know, we also want to make sure that we can take more time on our, on production of content and do higher quality. It's like, well, okay, those things are good. But, you know, oftentimes the easiest way to goose traffic is just to fire hose lots of stuff. And that's in direct conflict with, you know, with, taking time to produce, you know, more carefully created and higher quality content. There's a lot of scenarios where as developers, and this is, I think what you guys mentioned, you know, I got my start at Lullabot actually as a senior developer and then an architect who was, you know, doing more of the planning and stuff like that. But I've never been on a project where those weren't things that developers had to grapple with. And to a large extent, we started doing strategy and started working with clients earlier in the process just because we wanted actual implementation projects to go smoother.
That makes a lot of sense. So if you have a lot of unclear goals and unclear guidelines, your development is not going to be
Right. Like, imagine a scenario where, you know, you're, say, putting together the a site, and you've got a, you know, let's say you've been told to build, quote, the dashboard for, you know, for the editorial users. And there's some sort of vague hand wavy ideas of what should go in the dashboard, but there hasn't been any time to flesh it out. Now, as a developer, theoretically, in Drupal, using views and some basic blocks, you can probably bang out a dashboard or something that meets that description in a fairly short period of time. The big hard question isn't, can I make a thing that we can call a dashboard? It's what should go there? Who's going to be using it? Why, you know, what do they need out of it? Those are the questions that are way more important than just the line item on a feature list or something like that. And that's the kind of stuff that we found, like, identifying audiences and workflows early on can make so much easier.
Let's not forget there's a dashboard in Drupal 7 core.
Oh, yeah. Well, but that's the thing. It's a tool for assembling dashboards.
Yep.
So what type of exercises do you do when you're, like, during these workshops?
A lot of guided visualization.
Okay.
No, I'm joking. Meditation, yoga.
Interpretive dance.
Calls. Yeah. Well, Jared, do you want to take this? I know your team has worked with it all. A lot of my exercises are very oriented towards, like, the content modeling stuff. But I think the design teams are also, like, really, they're more sort of the gathering early intentions and desires from the client type of stuff too.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different things we do. We don't necessarily have here's what a Lullabot workshop is, and it's this many hours or this many days, and it's these exact things. We tailor those to each project and problem set, but the kinds of things we do, there's a lot of commonality. We have sort of like a broad playbook, and depending on the need, we'll be doing things like so on the more sort of what maybe people classically think of design, like the, you know, the feel and the look and that kind of stuff. Like, we'll do things like, rather than just sitting down and saying, well, we're going to take some notes, tell us about your brand and what you want it to be like. We've usually done work ahead of time, and whether the client already has a style guide that we're following or something like, or through initial conversations with them, so that when we're in the workshopping phase, we're actually doing things like we're coming in with pre-built boards of, like, things like, for example, we'll do a game we call the experience metaphors game or the exercise. And we'll have come to the workshop with a bunch of images, and we'll say, or a bunch of example metaphors, and basically to facilitate the conversation of, like, what should it feel like to use this product? We'll be showing brands, and we'll say, you know, should using your website feel like checking in at a W hotel, or should it feel like checking in at a Hampton Inn? You know, like, should it feel like that's maybe a bad example, but like, should people buying this feel like they're buying, you know, a Betty Crocker, you know, ready-made thing, or should they feel like they're checking out at Blue Apron, you know, to set up food to come? And so usually creating metaphors for things like even things like, you know, is this going to have a lot of, you know, technical whiz bang, things that front end developers like Mike Herschel end up caring a lot about, like, whoa, like, you've blown our whiz bang budget here in the first month of the project, and we still have like
That's a thing. I can call that.
Well, I actually coined that phrase at our last design and development retreat. I was saying that, so we do a thing called the performance budget. And I was saying that we should develop a whiz bang budget where we begin scoring whiz bang based on, you know, feasibility. Like, so, 'cause our developers are like, we're capable of doing almost anything.
It's computers.
Within reason. Yeah. It's computers. Browsers have some constraints and whatnot. It's just, how many things can you do without either being too expensive? Like now it's going to create a bad experience because it's using up everything this person has in their browser or in their broadband connection or whatever, or it's using up all of the time of our front end developers. And therefore, you know, so anyway, but the experience metaphor thing is to try to like frame like what this thing should be like via metaphor so that it's less about like, we just want to use carousels or we want everything to slide in and have this feel app like, but it's more, we're sort of starting from a place of it's a little easier to engage with and make decisions around. And we do the same kinds of things with, you know, brand as well. But I'm trying to think on the, we do a lot of things that are sort of trying to get our head around, you know, we'll take the content model, for example, and we'll break out the various content types that make up structurally what they're planning to do. And we'll do dual access card sorting or like sticky note sorts where, and sometimes we do it in succession. Sometimes we have everybody participate all at once. It depends on the, what we're trying to get out of it, but we'll have people do things like take, you've got these five different kinds of content that you're making right now. You've expressed these concerns about, you know, your goal is by the end of the thing to have more premium feeling content. And that's in part possible via the design, but also we need to know where we want to focus the design energy to accomplish that. So, you know, the vertical access is how often your users are using this thing right now. And the horizontal access axis is how important, how valuable this kind of content is to your business. Like, you know that actually a ton of our ad revenue comes right now from these kinds of articles or whatever. And getting, having different people do it separately can be really useful when what you're seeing is competing priorities. Like you're in the lead up to workshopping, you hear the CEO tell you like, It's for us, it is all about articles and it's articles. And that's my goal and vision for the company. And then you end up talking to one of the customer service leads and they're like, you know, everybody's complaining about like that all they use this for is these downloadable resources. And they're a pain right now to get to because of the way that we've gated them. And so when you're hearing competing things, it can be very interesting to have people do this in succession and then see what everybody did. And that facilitates conversations and can help lead to decisions. So that was a really long example, but some actual examples.
Well, one of the really common exercises we also do, especially like sort of early on with organizations that are trying to suss out some of their priorities, is an exercise that I think you referred to, but it originally came from Margot Bloomstein's book, Content Strategy at Work. It's a sort of card sort that starts with about 100 different cards with like various just, you know, descriptive words on them. Oftentimes they, you know, they're like completely incompatible words like premium and budget. And the idea is, you know, you sort these into sort of three categories of what currently describes us, what we want to describe us in the future, and what we don't want to describe us at all. And the idea is you sort of get a picture of like where we are right now, what we want to make sure we want to avoid, and where we're trying to go. And it's, you know, a lot of these, you know, some of these kinds of exercises come from the world of like branding strategy and stuff like that. But going into the process of like a big, say, website re-architecture, it can be really critical to figure out what those messages are, because those messages aren't just for like slogans and stuff like that. It's the stuff that's communicated in what gets prioritized on the page, where, you know, the way Jared was talking about, you know, where the design energy goes into. What are we going to spend the most time refining and iterating? You know, what are we going to not only give the most prominent visual treatment on a given page, but like, what are we going to steer people towards in terms of the architecture of the site and the navigation and, you know, recommendations and just reading and pacing and stuff like that. So those are some of the tools that we use to sort of help suss that stuff out. One of the things like on the more technical side, the exercises that we often go to are like just going through and doing a quick, you know, inventory style. What are the different kinds of things you make? You know, podcasts, articles, newsletters, whatever. Oftentimes we'll do early inventories before we actually do the workshop. So we've sort of got a pre-built list to work with. And we're usually talking with people and making sure that nothing's been missed. But then we'll ask them things like, okay, so, you know, there's some priority questions. How many people actually use this? Do you have numbers on it? Do you have any feedback from, you know, anecdotes about what people get out of this? Do you know who in your audience each of these things is really best suited for? You know, are there like, are podcasts really good for let's say you're a nonprofit and one of your core audiences is parents who are, you know, really concerned about a particular issue with their local school districts, but your secondary audience is legislators, lawmakers, potential donors who happen to do a lot of travel. And what you know is, hey, they actually are able to listen to podcasts and they are much more receptive to things like issue-oriented sort of landing pages that organize all resources on a given topic on our site. So podcasts and landing pages are great for our donors and stuff like that. But newsletters and sort of, blasts on particular local topics are great for our parents. And starting to sort of map the different audiences that, you know, you have to the messages, content types. The idea isn't necessarily that, you know, there's some magical matrix of, you know, all the questions we must get answered with each client, but to sort of figure out what different sets of questions, what different exercises and discussions we can walk them through to get the best understanding of what they're making, what they're trying to accomplish, and, you know, how to get that in people's hands. And, you know, sometimes that's like, you know, persona discussions, who are your users and what defines them. Other times that's, you know, what are all the different distribution mediums that you are sending your content out through, and, you know, what are the stats for each of them, and, you know, what are the requirements and stuff like that. Other times I think one of the things that's popular in the marketing communications world is like journey maps. You know, when a person first encounters us, what's the journey for them from hearing about us to eventually, you know, working with us as a company. All of those things can inform what we end up building, even if we're not like a marketing agency, or even if like the developers that are involved aren't doing, you know, some sort of big brand strategy. The sort of richer understanding of what's being built can be really valuable. And I think very early in the podcast, you mentioned like, how do we improve the sort of gap in, you know, between when the requirements are made and when it gets built. And I think there's really no substitute for getting representatives from the tech team that's going to actually be doing the building at the table when some of these things are being discussed, in the same way that, you know, getting editorial folks at the table when the design is being discussed is really critical. And I think that's, you know, sort of one of the reasons that strategy inside of Lullabot also means sort of bringing Drupal architectural knowledge and CMS architectural knowledge to the table during that early design process. I think that's critical. And we've also found that making sure that there's time and sort of breathing room for some of the members of the design team to stay on with the project and help the implementation team resolve questions as they come up that relate to the design, rather than just treating it as the design phase, which ends and then goes to implementation. Making sure there's sort of a fuzzy overlap between those and that there's a slow handoff and exchange of knowledge as work is being done makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about getting a web project off to a good start with Jared Ponshot, the creative director of Lullabot, and Jeff Eaton, the senior digital strategist. We're at that intersection of design and content strategy. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit about some pitfalls that you might want to look out for in your next web project. Right after this. Oh my goodness, it's lead developer and trainer Joe Schindler from Drupalize Me.
It's true.
Hi, Joe.
Oh my goodness.
So what's going on at Drupalize Me these days?
I've been busy getting ready to do a Drupal 8 theming training at MidCamp coming up later this week, actually. Blake Hall and I are traveling to Chicago to do a theming training there. And we're super excited about it. It's been a while since Drupalize Me has done any in-person training. We kind of took a break from it after the need sort of petered out a bit for Drupal 7. And now with Drupal 8 out, we're giving it a shot again. And we're doing a introduction to theming Drupal 8. And I think it's going to be awesome.
That's exciting, Joe. I hadn't heard about that yet. That's really cool. You know, it kind of reckons back to the old days of Lullabot with the in-person trainings and the, you know, getting out and preaching the good news of Drupal 8.
Oh, yeah, it totally does. And, you know, for me, I absolutely love the opportunity to, like, teach people about Drupal in person, both because it feels good, but also it's always interesting to watch the different things that people struggle with and what we can learn from that in order to make the content for Drupalize Me better. And you learn things about what people are learning in a different way than when they're just watching a video and you have no idea what they're watching and which part of the video they're kind of like looking at you and being like, Joe, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. Joe, you and I have been in the front of conference rooms together before teaching that kind of stuff. And I think it was super fun to me. You know, Drupal's been our passion for 7 or 8 years or more by now. And getting in front of people who are doing it for their job and watching them discover the things that you're teaching is a whole lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. It's so cool. That and like you said, we've been doing this for a very long time. And there are absolutely things about Drupal that I think I sort of take for granted at this point. And I forget how cool it is when you first figure out that the Devel module has a function which lets you, you know, inspect the contents of variables in a way that's slightly easier than var dump.
So, Joe, when is MidCamp?
MidCamp is this coming weekend. Trainings are on Thursday. The camp takes place over the weekend. There's a sprint on Sunday.
Yeah. Trainings are on Thursday, which is the day that this will be published.
Sweet. Well, also, we're going to be doing this training at DrupalCon in Baltimore as well, and we're looking to also do it at a couple of other camps this summer. So if you've got a camp that you think would be a good fit for a Drupal 8 theming training, let us know. Reach out to the Drupalize Me team.
Welcome back. We're talking content strategy and design with Jared Ponchot and Jeff Eaton. Hey, Jeff Eaton, I heard you might have a podcast that has something to do with this topic.
Indeed. It's called Insert Content Here, and it's been sporadically published over the past several years.
Sporadic is kind of generous.
Well, it was published pretty regularly for a while, and then I went on hiatus for about a year and a half. But the good news is it is back, and the relaunch of Insert Content Here is actually about to happen next week, and going to have Nazar Bina, who does a lot of work with intelligent content and cross-channel content work. He's going to be on the podcast talking about all kinds of cool stuff with domain modeling and even how AI is starting to come into some content strategy work, which is pretty sweet.
Are you calling this series 2 of the podcast?
This is technically series 3.
Okay.
I decided to go after the BBC television show naming approach. Series 1, series 2, series 3.
Similar to semantic versioning?
Yes, yes. That's totally what I should do. You know, insert content here 3.2.0. But it's exciting stuff, and the focus of the podcast is basically on like content strategy, digital publishing, CMS stuff, and like the cool projects and technologies and like skills that are involved in all of that stuff. So yeah, check it out. It's in the lullabot.com podcast section. I believe you can also just hit insertcontenthere.com.
And it has it's a podcast that in the theme music has something like scatting, so it's really fun to listen to.
It is pretty cool.
So Jared, you've been involved in many, many design design projects.
I have.
Tell us about when they go off the rails, when things just start to fall apart. And if you can, I know that you might not be able to mention clients specifically, but as much in detail as you can, I would like to hear that. And then maybe on how to avoid that and lessons learned.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of ways that design projects, you know, don't go well historically for all kinds of agencies, not just ours. And I think in terms of like what are some of the commonalities, there's like things I've seen a lot or things that we're really intentional about. Some of the workshopping we do is actually very intentionally to set us up to avoid those things, or to give us like the help, you know, the helper things to get everything back on the rails when things seem to be heading in a different direction. I think one of the actual workshopping things that I was thinking of when Jeff was talking earlier was that actually developers would probably really like this one. In terms of priorities, we often end up doing this exercise in our workshopping where we call it phase mapping. And so it's usually sort of later in the workshopping process when we've seen that there are just a lot of things that are important in this project. And so we'll have the key team, usually it'll like hopefully have representatives there that are from like top level leadership. The CFO might participate, but we'll have like the content lead person, we'll have a marketing lead, we'll have, you know, the technical lead, we'll have, you know, all these people participating, and we'll basically create either cards or sticky notes for all the things that we've heard that are like, you know, great articles, or, you know, like, you know, downloadable white papers, or all the different things that ever this site is going to need to do and that they think are real important that we've talked about. And we'll either set up, if it's cards, we'll actually get three different tables. Or if it's sticky notes, we'll just create zones, three different zones on the wall. And the team collaboratively has to, they can't put any more than five, you know, a handful of things into phase one. And a handful of things. So they basically have to choose and whittle down the what's really important in this project. And they have to whittle it down into phases. Like if we were to launch a site that only had five things, like what would it be? And then we even have conversations about, can we get away with that? Can we move iteratively towards an initial launch that's simpler and build upon it? And it facilitates really great conversations about launch strategies and ways of working iteratively together, which can be really helpful for getting our clients set up for success longer term, not just in the project that they've brought us in to help them with. Because, you know, we do projects for clients because basically like our clients many times already have people who know how to do these things. They have designers, they have developers. Those people are just really busy with a full-time job. They don't have the bandwidth to be able to take on this full redesign and rebuild of the main product over here or this thing here. And so they need extra muscle. They need help. And that's kind of what we do. But we also want to set them up so that down the road, like they the patterns for how they make decisions and how they make changes to this product over time and stuff are good. And so this sort of like getting people thinking in phases, even if like you cannot form an SOW with this company because of the way their sourcing works or whatever, and it's going to be phased, it's still helpful to be able to work that way as a project team. You know, even if, you know, the SOW for this project is for this whole thing, but we all know, and everybody's agreed to, even up to the CEO, that phase one is we're going to get to where we have these things functional and everybody's really happy with it. And phase two is this, and phase three is this, and launches at this point or whatever. So
that makes sense. It almost reminds me of kind of sprinting.
Yes. Yeah. It's like sprint planning kind of a thing. But yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff is where a lot of projects go off the rails because there's not agreement on what's really important. And it's basically, you know, either over promise, you know, under promise so that we can over deliver and make everybody uncomfortable up front. But what most companies do is sort of like, this can probably happen. And the further along you get, the more you're disappointing people. And it's like, let the whole project team and the clients participate early on in that process together. As opposed to like your project manager going off and doing a bunch of sprint planning based on the requirements list and coming back and saying, here's what I've got and here's how I think we can do it. That's a way. I don't know if Jeff wants to jump in. There are other things that come to mind about like design projects going off the rails. Often I think designers that like, you can it's a bit of an illusion to think that you can take these UX practices and methods and just go in and like make something better right away. Like all we need to know is like, give us the problem and we'll solve it. Because oftentimes like the problem that is felt is not the core problem. And so you can see design projects go off the rails when you sort of jump too quickly into solving the felt problem, only to discover later on that there's all this extra work that's going to need to happen because we halfway into this discovered the core problem. And now we've already committed to solving their problems, kind of a thing, because of the way our SOW set up or whatever. And so things like a real world example of this, we went into a project where a client told us that the two main, like they were very explicit from the very beginning. The main goals for this project are to increase time on site and to increase the number of leads generated for their sales process. Like this was they sell a online product, but it's an enterprise level product and people could basically click a button and fill out a thing to like set up a meeting with where they would get a demo of the thing and like get it tailored to their company and that kind of stuff. And as we dug into this work, like we could have just said, well, we've actually got experience of how like things you do like to increase time on site and let's solve for that problem. But what actually we discovered after spending more time with both their sales representatives, who are the ones talking every day, literally to these people that need to click this button, and their customer support representatives and actual customers using the product, what we discovered was that actually the real problem in getting people to sign up was to take away so much obfuscation and like let them really quickly get quick answers to the things that everybody is actually asking, that like, if I knew this, I would just go ahead and set up a demo. And if we successfully do that, what we're going to effectively do is decrease time on site quite a bit, because we're going to make it a lot easier for people to get what they need on this site. And so it was, you know, and there was a lot of work in the workshopping to get everybody on board with the idea that, hey, like a decrease in time on site by the end of this may actually not be a bad thing. And what makes this business keep going is more sales. And like, so let's prioritize these things and let's make sure that the ways of measuring our success are things that are actually measuring success, as opposed to measuring something that just feels like a problem to everybody.
Jeff, what issues have you ran into with content strategy where people are not on the same page and they're kind of at each other's necks and you're having to mediate and pull people together?
You could almost say, how does it not happen? This is actually something before I even really dove into the world of content strategy that I think was sort of a deeply internalized lesson. And one is the assessment of the current existing content on an existing site doesn't happen soon enough, or like the migration process of actually figuring out all of the in the weeds details of the existing content and how to map it to the new work that's being done happens far too late in the process. It's like it's a tale as old as time, but that's one of the easiest ways for things to go completely off the rails.
Oftentimes, the people who will actually be using the CMS on an ongoing basis, like the people who create, edit, manage content that's coming in and going out, are not treated as like actual members of the planning and design and, you know, idea forming process. They're treated as like the people that need to be sold on what's been decided after it's all been figured out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen this a lot, oftentimes in organizations where there's sort of a historical like divide between the people who build stuff and the people who use stuff, where it's like, okay, we've got all these problems we know we need to sort out, but those folks are just gonna, you know, they're just gonna confuse and muddle things if we let them in on this. So we'll just iron everything out, and then, you know, we'll tell them what's being done. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen that go well. You know, it it turns the whole process into sort of a telephone game, and it means that the people who have the most hands-on experience with the failures and the day-to-day needs of the system are the last ones to know what's actually being done. And, you know, oftentimes what really happens is the project just ends up dragging out longer, and there's scope creep, and, you know, just sort of things get stretched and stretched in order to accommodate the things that are discovered once the project is dumped into the hands of those people who will be using it day to day. And it's sort of disheartening, because I've seen projects where it happened the other way, where, you know, those folks were an integrated part of what was going on from day one, and how much of a difference that made.
So how do you integrate them? Do you bring them into meetings? Do you have certain representatives?
Yeah. I mean, you know, oftentimes it's not like you can have every single content editor there during the decision-making process, but usually there's like, you know, just as there's somebody from the tech team and, you know, somebody from the analytics team or something like that, making sure that there's, you know, one or two folks who can sort of represent the perspectives and the experience of the actual editorial or content production team makes a huge difference. And usually, like, we've found that they're the ones who end up sort of being a go-between, or like the person who sort of communicates some of the, you know, what's coming up and, you know, what needs to be figured out to the other people in the organization. And we found so many times when those folks are able to bubble up stuff like, oh yeah, here's an actual completely, here's like a second CMS, you know, buried on an old server somewhere that's still very critical to our workflow that no one even knew about. And, you know, the tech team will go, oh, we thought that was decommissioned like 2.5 years ago. And like, nope, still use it. And it, you know, it's just one of those things. The more different angles you can come at it from, the more perspectives you can bring in, the more valuable it is. And I feel like that's a really big part of the responsibilities of a strategist coming in, not just capturing what's being told, but sort of like spotting those gaps in who's at the table and recognizing when there are like those sort of suspicious silent spots where you feel like there ought to be noise coming from here, but there isn't. Something doesn't feel right.
Yeah, it's also important to note that a lot of the clients, not all the clients we work with, but a lot of clients that we work with, like, content is their product, or content is their business. And yeah, I think in design, same thing is very true. Like, one of the sort of foundational things to the way our design team works is making sure that we're not, when we say user experience and empathy for users, that we're remembering that site editors are users too. You know, the business is a user too. You know, making sure that all of those things are represented and listened to and heard well and integrated into the decision-making process, in a design process. And I would say on the design side, at least, yeah, we pretty much do that just by literally integrating those people. And like Jeff said, it's not always an entire team, but there are times when it's a large enough group that it's like not ideal for a particular kind of workshopping, but we'll develop like in a multi-day workshop experience, we'll pull in different ones for different exercises so that we're actually hearing different voices from that same team, because that team is so critical. You know, it, like, in whether that's, you know, engineering or content and editorial or marketing or sales or customer service or whatever it is, you know, we often have that happen where it's like, well, this exercise is actually going to get really unwieldy with 30 people, but can include different people for different ones.
And I think speaking to what we were talking about a little bit before in terms of the handoff and the trade-off stuff, especially on large projects where like the systems that an organization uses on a day-to-day basis are changing. Sometimes that can be like a corporate intranet that everyone uses daily. Sometimes it could be like, you know, the CMS that everybody uses to sort of centralize their, you know, publishing and, you know, client contact stuff. But in addition to the discovery process, making sure that things like, you know, weekly or biweekly demos and check-ins and, you know, sprint reviews, that there are also people, you know, representatives from those key groups that are present, sort of understanding as it continues to move forward and evolve, you know, what's going on. Because that's, you know, that's another one of those places where I feel like the sort of shared vision that's established in an early discovery can sync.
One of the most common, when we were talking about things going off the rails in design projects, there's the infamous, what's called the swoop and poop. That's a
term.
Basically,
you've never heard of the swoop and poop. This is just referring to when all of a sudden, late in the game in a project, a key stakeholder whose voice has not been integrated very well up to this point comes in and drops a change on everybody. makes it so, oh, wait, now we have to redo this thing, or we have to rethink this, or we thought this was all approved and this is what we've been building on. And
how did you actually not know webinars had to be everywhere?
Right. How did you not know webinars had to be everywhere? So, that's actually like one of the things in the workshopping phase, but just sort of throughout, is finding ways to make sure, like, what are the key voices and how do we integrate them into the entire process?
To have them poop earlier.
Yeah, exactly. You want poop early and often, that should be the name of this podcast.
I've actually heard that concept referred to as seagull stakeholders.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really interesting kind of listen to you talk about like how that integrates into sprints and agile and how everything integrates together. Do you have any strategies for developers or any methods that might be handy for developers for content strategy or design if we're kind of alpha on our own?
I would say probably I jokingly refer to strategy work as like the professional practice of being 3 years old, because it's, you know, one of the common themes is continually asking why. And I think that's something that can be really useful, because I think it's a lot of developers care about the why behind what they're building, but it's very easy, especially in a development shop that gets like requirements-based work from clients, to approach it as, here's the specs, we build the specs, we ship what we've built, and, you know, we avoid pain by sticking to the script. Although that can be like, it's easy to defend contractually, it can often lead to sort of like a blinder's view of what's being made. And the more you can ask why and understand the reasoning and the motivations behind some of the things that are being created and the decisions that have been made sort of before it got turned into a spec, the better equipped you are to deal with other unexpected stuff that comes up. And sort of the closer you are to understanding and engaging with some of those strategic questions. You don't necessarily have to be in charge of charting the course or setting the strategy for a project to engage with those questions and use some of these techniques that we've been talking about to better understand what you're building.
Yeah, I think the two-axis card sort kind of a model, and whether that's like if you're all working, you know, in a distributed fashion and you don't have the luxury of like, well, let's get everybody on site together and workshop this. Like, this is a big problem. I actually just did this last week I just made some Trello boards and sent each person their own Trello board with pre-formatted columns and a whole bunch of cards on the left. And they had to do their sorts based on that. And then we could then discuss that together. You can also just have people literally do their own sorts and take a photo and share it, but to facilitate discussions. But when you find multiple things in tension, figuring out like a way to turn one into an X-Y axis and one into a Y axis, and forcing people to like put a dot on the board for where this thing fits, and then letting people visualize the problem together like that can actually be really useful. And it doesn't matter whether it's purely a design decision or whether it's, you know, just competing priorities, you know, over well, you know, this feature and that feature, we don't have time to build both, you know.
It's funny. I think a lot of the techniques for like getting a group of people together, like with a whiteboard and just, you know, ironing out priorities, I like to think of it as sort of flipping around the techniques that like charting and data visualization lean on. Like, you know, if you look at like Edward Tufte's books on, you know, visualizing information and stuff like that, a lot of it is about how to clearly capture like the relationship between different kinds of things and communicate those to people. And stuff like cards, visual card sorting and grouping stuff, you know, like grouping post-its together into clumps to figure out how relationships to each to things work. And that two-axis card sort that Jared was talking about that allows people to sort of weigh in on what the, you know, the balance is between things that might be in tension. Those are basically about taking the easy to grasp, you know, visualization techniques for like communicating relationships and information visually and flipping it around so that instead of saying, you know, oh, well, I rank this an 8 and I rank this a 2 or something like that, they're placing it on a board visually in order to sort of, you know, put a stake in the ground. And I've found it really interesting to look at how data visualization techniques work to figure out how we might, you know, what kinds of ways we might flip that around, like, you know, what kind of, you know, make this bigger or smaller to say how important it is or something like that. Basically having people control the placement of something in order to, you know, tell how important they think it is.
Yeah. One other example that just occurred to me that has been really helpful at times, and this could be really helpful even if you're a small team of developers and you've been brought into a project where they already have designs and everything, and you're being asked to do this and integrate with a couple other people at the company, and what is the roles and responsibilities sorting. So, you know, this sort of central question for the exercise is, you know, what are the things that we've got to get done together throughout the course of this project, and who's going to take ownership of each of these things? And so you generate a list live together just via conversation, sort of popcorn style, people calling it out and put it on a card or put it on a sticky note or put it on a, you know, a Google Draw board or something if you're remote, or and list of responsibilities and the things that need to get made, have a sticky note or something for each, and then have a column for not needed, won't do, so that the project team as a team is actually going to actually call out and just acknowledge the things that we're all in agreement that people might think it'd be normal for us to actually make this thing or do this thing, but we all agree, like, we can work efficiently on this project. We're not going to do that, but making sure that those decisions are collective decisions. And it's been even like somebody's had to look at the board and say, that's in the won't do, or that's in the not needed. And then assign owners to all of these things. It can give you this like amazing clarity to move more quickly and avoid some of the weird things that can happen in projects where it's sort of like you're burning time making things that are just sort of like there's a felt need for it, but if you actually had a chance to really workshop it together, everybody would actually probably agree you don't need to be doing that. So
sounds like very practical advice.
Yeah.
So Jared, Jeff, any final thoughts, anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Not that I can think of. I mean, I think the one thing that comes to mind is just that, like, you know, one of the biggest things for our design team is just that we work with developers. And even when we're brought in on projects where, you know, they already have a development team, or we did a big project where they had another development company that already contracted with when they came to us. When we planned out the workshopping phase, a requirement in our proposal for it was at least, you know, the key representatives from that dev team are going to be there and part of the workshop. And I would say if you're a developer out there who listens to this podcast regularly, you know, talk about, like, find way, like, even if you end up having to give some of your time so that you can be there for a day of a workshop that's happening or something in a project you're doing, you can provide a ton of value and you can get a ton of value.
Any final thoughts, Jeff Eaton?
Yes. I would probably say, in addition to all the stuff that Jared was saying, if you're working on web projects that involve, like, a medium to large amount of content and they're succeeding, you are probably doing some of this stuff already. You know, you're probably grappling with some of these questions already, even if, you know, you don't have, you know, strategist or, you know, designer in your title, even if you don't have a process around it. These are questions that I think everybody who deals with, you know, complex content-oriented sites has to, you know, has to wrestle with. And, you know, it doesn't have to be some big highfalutin thing, but learning to sort of be a little more intentional with some of these things and maybe add a couple of more tools to your toolbox as you run into these questions can make a huge difference.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Great to be a part of the Swoop and Poop episode.